You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Connie Burtka. Good morning, Connie, it's good to have you.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Eric.
And thank you for being able to call in from Maryland outside D.C. Is that correct? Yes.
That's correct. Rockville, Maryland.
Rockville, Maryland. So, Connie, the way we start the show is we ask, who are you? And that's kind of give us a picture of your qualities or labels or whatever so we can start the conversation. It's a way to model getting to know each other here. And you're also connected to Ithaca because of something that came here from the Smithsonian. And maybe say a little bit about that, too.
Sure. So, in all fairness, the first time I came to Ithaca was with my family, maybe just 3 years ago, and we wanted to go camping in and around the Finger Lakes. So that was my first trip to Ithaca. So I was delighted when the Ithaca Library was chosen as one of the libraries that would host the Smithsonian Institution's Human Origins Traveling Exhibit.
Uh-huh.
So that was actually my second trip to Ithaca, and you know what? I had a great time both times, and I think I'll be back again.
Good.
But the exhibit, as I hope by now several people have had a chance to see it or go to some of the events that the library is helping to sponsor. But it's really, the exhibit presents scientific discoveries about human origins. And it's really trying to encourage a broader conversation about what it means to be human. So it was a delight. We just got back from Ithaca last week, and we had a wonderful time there. I think every event I was able to participate in, we were very pleased with the reception of the community and the willingness of people to have the kind of conversations we'd like to have.
Good. Now, the purpose of the show is really to get to know you and get to know how you have taken on some of the interests and the life experiences that you've had that have shaped the way you engage the world. So I am serious. Who are you? Besides, we can infer a camper from this.
Sure. So my background, which is where people usually start, so I'll get that stuff out of the way.
Sure.
I'm a planetary scientist by training and worked many years as a research scientist. But I also have always had this desire to share science and share what I was learning through science. And part of that was reflected in running an intern program at the Carnegie Institution of Washington, where we were able to work with really, for the most part, very gifted kids who were thinking about science as a career. And several times in getting to know these kids over the summer, I would see that for many of them, their religious beliefs were a concern for them and how this would mesh with their desire to be in the sciences. And I got pretty interested in how people's religious beliefs impact their own engagement with sciences. And that led me to think about what's actually being taught at seminary. That's the kind of the, you know, objective side of it. But obviously people work from their own life experiences. And I personally had been raised Catholic. Went to Catholic school for 12 years, which was a real, for my parents to be able to come up with the funds to send us to a private Catholic school was something they worked really hard for, and I clearly appreciated that. And my experiences there were pretty good, especially in high school, where, I think having teenagers of my own now, that's the time when you really start to figure out who you are and what your own beliefs about the world are. And so I went through probably the typical struggles with thinking about how to mesh my religious beliefs with science, but I really didn't experience them in the way I think some other people have, because in the tradition I grew up in, I was really encouraged to think about these things.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not Catholic today. I belong to Unitarian Universalist Church, but it really has little to nothing to do with science and religion, but more about kind of finding the community that you feel most comfortable with and feel like you can be yourself with. But that aside, I you know, I had that background, went to a seminary, which was a Protestant seminary, and that was also an eye-opener for me, too, because in terms of religion, I'd been hanging around largely with Catholics. And so I saw, you know, a whole other different way of looking at the world and looking at Scripture. So certainly understanding that piece of me and the fact that I, you know, the way I did this, literally I could put an experiment up at the lab and drive down the road 10 minutes, take a class, go back to the lab, and people didn't even necessarily know I was gone. And it really, you know, it was like walking into to and from two different worlds. Mm-hmm. And largely what I learned in seminary in terms of the original question that drove me there is that science people weren't antagonistic to it. It just didn't seem to be part of the equation in what they were thinking about and what they were doing. But I certainly enjoyed the different perspective on the world, and I ended up staying there part-time 12 years until eventually I walked away with a degree in theology, which led me to eventually move to a program at the American Association for the Advancement of Science, Program of Dialogue on Science, Ethics, and Religion. And I pretty much, you know, just to summarize, that's kind of where I still am today. I'm very interested in science and society, and particularly the relationship between science and religious beliefs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, we are going to delve into that, and you have other avocations too that are your passions as well, between being a parent and I understand rescuing bicycles, repairing them, and distributing them. You know.
Yeah. Sometimes, and it's interesting. When I look back on which you know, preparing for an interview with Eric Clay really inspires you to do that. Kind of look back on where you've been and where you're going. And I have to say that doing something in the community has always been a part of who I am. And maybe that really does harken back to my association with Catholicism in my early years, because I think it, you know, just being able to give back, being able to do something, and what that particular thing is has changed through the years. You know, my kids were younger, I was a Girl Scout leader,
right.
Then I was involved in RE, but the latest thing is bicycling, and it really, you know, it just touches on so many things that I care about in terms of enabling people to get to and from jobs, getting people out in the outdoors enjoying themselves. Yeah, rescuing these bikes that would be trashed and watching people come together and you know, give them a second life and send them back out into the community. And it's, you know what? It's also a break from thinking about science and religion.
Yes.
It's a chance to get your hands dirty and do something. And, you know, you look out, you see all these things in the world you'd like to change. And, you know, you're doing the best you can. But sometimes you need to do something and you see the result. You know, you do it, you hand off the bike, and it's like, yeah, that was a good day.
Yeah, yeah. And you brought some music with you, too, or you have some music. So we're going to start with Michelle Schacht and Come a Long Way. Do you want to say anything about it, or just let it, or just play it? How do you want to handle that?
Well, I can tell you this particular song. A friend of mine, a very dear friend of mine, who now lives an ocean away, but we try to keep in touch, introduced me to this song at a time that we both decided we should get a license to ride a motorcycle. So we took a motorcycle class together, and this is Michelle Schacht is telling a story here about the meaning of her motorcycle in her life.
Okay, well, here we go.
I kicked in his door at 5 a.m. I come for my bike, I told a repo man, my 920's gonna take me far today. You can travel for miles and never leave L.A. I've come a long way, I've gone 500 miles.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Connie Burtka. So, Connie, can you tell me a little bit about what experiences or what led you into a career in science?
Yeah, so I think I had always kind of had this, you know, how does that work? I want to understand this. And I'll have to say the way, maybe a big part of my relationship with my dad, who always had me out tromping through the woods or fishing or watching him take things apart and put them back together again, I just kind of grew up feeling really comfortable with questions about how things work. And when I got to high school, this is almost embarrassing now to look back on it. I had a choice, one choice. All the other classes are laid out for you except whether you want to take history or earth science. And I had a terrible experience with history in grade school. It just seemed to be about memorization, you know, the opposite of how do things work and why are things the way they are, which I don't feel that way about history now at all. But,
right. But
so I took earth science. And boy, I just it just really struck me. And I actually had an experience out riding my bike at that time as well. And I fell off the bike. And the first thing, I opened my eyes and I see this really shiny rock. And I start, you know, I'm laying there, you know, you fall off and you're like, gotta figure out if everything works before you try to move again.
A little dazed.
And I'm just sitting there staring at this rock, and I took the rock to school with me and talked to the earth science teacher about it. And I don't think I ever looked back. By that summer, I was working in a geology lab, at the University of Toledo. And, I just absolutely loved it. And I was so fortunate to have, you know, teachers who helped me along the way. Got to college and had a TA there who had this idea that I should apply for a program at the Lunar and Planetary Institute in Houston. And it may not seem that way today, but in the 80s, you didn't hear a lot about planetary science.
That's
at least
right.
I didn't. But I had this opportunity then at a very impressionable age to actually be where all the lunar samples were. And the person I worked with was the curator for that collection. And literally at night, this was a different time, I could go into the lab and, you know, say hi to the security guard and basically decide, well, where on the moon do I want to go tonight? And just look at the rocks for the fun of looking at them, right?
Wow.
And that really changed my whole perspective. You know, Earth wasn't just Earth anymore. It was a terrestrial planet in one solar system.
One among
many.
And
by the time I got to graduate school, I brought with me a very different, you know, it became clear to me that I can't really understand the Earth unless I broaden my perspective and think about other planets as well.
Right.
Which I think now, you know, with all the exploration and exoplanets and astrobiology, this may be more of a common experience for graduate students,
right.
but at the time it was pretty novel.
Right, right. That's really, really neat. So where did you go? College, grad school, you know, what evolved for you in this process?
Well, I didn't have a lot of money, and it was up to myself pretty much to get myself through school. And
your parents did Catholic
off.
School, but not college.
They didn't have the money.
Yeah.
I had some money from a great uncle, and I took a job as a maid at Ramada Inn over the summer before I was going to go away to school. And I started pretty much with enough money to go 1 year. I had saved up. You know, I don't think a kid could do that today, but at that time, as long as you stayed in state, you know, you could do it. And once I got there, I just threw myself into my studies and, you know, put together different scholarships and had to take on some loans as well, which my parents helped me sign off on. But the undergrad wasn't much of a choice. In the sciences, you know, by the time you get to graduate school, now you have some choice. And if you're in a program, they usually provide living expenses as well as paying tuition. So by that time, I kind of had figured out that I liked thinking about, it's kind of funny because, you know, I love the outdoors, but I ended up in geology working in an area that you're pretty much indoors because I went into experimental petrology, which is where you make your, pretty much you use equipment that can go to high pressures and temperatures, and you make your own rocks. And there were only a few places in the country that it was really worth considering going to do that. And I went out to Arizona State, and maybe, you know, the hook wasn't just the folks there, but the desert.
Yeah.
And the whole area. And, oh, boy, I just had a wonderful time there. And I, for many years, I said, I'm going back to Arizona because I loved it so much. But I took a internship then at Carnegie Institution of Washington, and there I met my husband, who was a student in China. So, you know, imagine the likelihood of this. One kid from a small rural farmland in Ohio meets a Chinese man from a small rural
yep.
farm town in China. I think our parents, you know, could not even begin to wrap their heads around this happening. But that has certainly, you know, talk about, you know, the same idea of you're studying Earth and then you're introduced to other planets while you grow up in the U.S. and now you marry a guy from China.
Right.
And this has, you know, this just blew up my world in another way in terms of having opportunities to see different perspectives. And we travel to China almost yearly to visit family there. My kids have been going since they were babies.
Mm-hmm.
And it has really, it just has given me a perspective on the world that I think it's hard to duplicate without having that kind of experience and having deep relationships on the other side of the world.
Sure.
And I speak barely a word of Chinese. But I am often struck by how similar things are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the things we care about are the things my Chinese family care about. It's just a wonderful. I guess that's really a big chunk of understanding mm-hmm. who mm-hmm. I am. And my kids, interestingly enough, really view themselves as they're getting older now and speaking more about it as having two homes,
right?
As having a home in China and having a home in the U.S.
And yeah, no, that that's a wonderful experience. And you also tend to be a person, I think, who sees the continuity or the connections rather than the differences.
If I don't see them, I feel like I'm always looking for them.
Yeah.
And I maybe having had those kind of experiences where, you know, you say the culture certainly is very different, but yet you very much can feel the similarities.
Yeah.
And in this work, in the whole science and religion area, you know, there is just so much. Unfortunately, it's often so much starts with assumptions and stereotypes.
Well, yes.
And you know, trying to get beyond that, and when people ask me a question, whether it's coming from the scientific community or religious community, I really like to start with the assumption that they're trying to understand. That this really, you know, that it's not a combative thing, that it's not somebody trying to highlight a conflict, but that this really is about trying to understand. And maybe sometimes it is, and maybe sometimes they are trying to be combative. But starting in my own head from that place, I think really makes a difference in how the conversation goes. Yeah.
And I guess I would frame it ever so slightly differently. Most people project that they want to understand on some level, and that allows us to be open to them without being defensive. But the core thing is they want to be understood. And this is the St. Francis prayer, whether you hope to want to understand
right.
more than to be understood. But on a crude level, we really do want to be understood. And so a lot of the science-religion dialogue goes south because people aren't really aware. They want to understand, but they first want to be understood. And it's really hard for one to give in to the other so you can actually get into the process. Because something's got to give. Because you can't start on both ends. That's been my experience anyway. And I find that there are problems on both sides because the ignorance or lack of knowledge among religious people about science is huge, especially about academic science as opposed to the kind of science associated with manufacturing or the STEM, you know, the core things that we're trying to do with the economy. And there's also just almost huge ignorance among scientists on the religious side, especially at the mature level of practice that you would have on the religious side, which is a really good knowledge of texts and how they work and how and what constitutes evidence on the religious side. It's sad.
I couldn't agree with you more. And one of my favorite experiences when I was directing the program of Dialogue on Science, Ethics, and Religion at AAAS, we had an advisory board. And, mainly the staff was doing the heavy lifting of the program, but obviously we wanted expertise. So we wanted a range of religious perspectives. We wanted scientists, particularly if there's an area we wanted to go off into. The staff would present their ideas or what we think about, or we'd elicit program ideas from the advisory committee. But you would have this room full of people. Most people serve, I think, 2 years with the option of renewing for two more years. And there was often, on both sides, some trepidation about being part of this.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the funnest things for me was to watch that fall aside as people got to know one another.
Mm-hmm.
And to watch both maybe particularly because by that time I had already had my experiences in seminary or was in the midst of them, so I knew that there was a deep level of scholarship here that these people, many of them, weren't aware of. So watching them meet some of these religious scholars for the first time and to see how things work in their world and vice versa. It's wonderful. You know, I often thought, is there some way we can maybe we should just record the advisory committee meetings and play them on TV at 7 o'clock in the evening or something.
Right.
So people could see how people could interact and get to know one another.
And I guess
over many years, this would happen over a 4-year period.
Right. And formal theology or ethics is very similar to scientific theory in terms of the way that you develop it and you reanalyze it and you produce it for review. But one of the things
that there's a community, that there's a community, that this isn't something you just pull out of the air that doesn't go under any kind of community critique.
Right.
It has that. There's a community of scholarship.
Right,
but it's
an intellectual community. And when I've tried to work across religious differences and science and religious differences, I've found that actually working with theologians or people who identify primarily as not research scientists per se at a particular level, like Roald Hoffman at a very high Nobel Prize winning level. They get it, but for the most part, I want to work with serious lay people because they're the ones who get out of the intellectualism and get to the practice. And it's in the practice where we have these abilities to kind of look at each other's lives and ask questions that aren't intellectual in nature, because the point of both the science and the religion isn't to get into the intellectualisms, but to do something profoundly practical. That's my bias.
Well, and that is a real challenge. And it's it's one of the places where, in terms of the AAAS program, I think we were really pushing. I have different feelings about it. In one sense, I think there has to be some hard and rigorous scholarship to think about how then do we take this out into the broad. Why does this matter? What do we do with this information? What do we do with what we've learned from each other? But if I have a criticism of the science and religion field per se, it's that still so much of that conversation seems to be happening at this intellectual level that a broader audience isn't even aware of.
Right.
Or it doesn't seem to touch on their lives.
It wouldn't make sense to them. And that's a bigger critique of the academy than just either science or religion, because both are kind of lost in that environment. And there's popularizing, which is a negative term, but there is real. And my experience has been people know a whole lot more than they realize. It's a matter of drawing it out of them, and to do that, they have to not be defensive. And expertise tends to make people defensive, especially if it's not their area of expertise. And so most of my work is trying to bring that to lower those barriers, so people can actually communicate about what they value, even if the other side doesn't understand quite what they're saying.
Well, the very first barrier I see is, where do the conversations take place? You know, where is there a place for people to have conversations like this one? I always felt so privileged to be part of the conversations that I was part of. And you know, yet I didn't, when I went to seminary, it wasn't any antagonistic stance towards science. It just wasn't a conversation that, it was like two separate worlds.
Right.
It didn't seem to matter. And I had an opportunity, and I was very, I still to this day, and I wish I had more time to kind of revive it, but I had an opportunity to teach a course on science and religion mm-hmm. for seminarians. And one comment I would often get on the evaluation of the class is that this should be a required course. We need a place to talk about this.
Right.
You know, that it was an elective, so people could go through seminary without ever having thought about some of these things.
Yeah,
and I don't know what we do to find a place for this conversation.
Right, and I think and on the other side, it needs to be within the academic. I mean, I teach in a science department. I teach religion and faith and practice at Cornell, and as a consultant. It's hard for some of them to welcome that, or in some of the students to see the connection. But by the time we're done with the semester, they have figured out a lot of different ways of making sense of things.
Yeah.
Let me do the station ID. What would you like? What song would you like to play next here? Think about it while I do the station ID. You're listening to WRFI,
sure.
Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Connie Burtka.
Well, how about Enya?
Okay. Here we go. And do you want to say something before we play it or after?
I just think it's one of the most beautiful songs I've ever heard. And, you know, kind of, for me, it just reminds me that there's a lot more hope in the world than I sometimes see.
Okay. How can I keep from singing?
My life goes on in endless song, a bard's lamentation. I hear the reed far off hum, the tales I knew.
Storm can change.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Connie Burtka. So, Connie, what I'm curious about is you have been working in the intersection of science and religion for many years. How have you had to change? How has your understanding of religion changed, or how has your understanding of science changed because of your engagement of religion? How have you personally had to kind of rethink things as this has worked its way forward?
Well, when I went into it, I was probably coming at it more from one side, you know, thinking, well, science to me was this wonderful, you know, eye-opening experience, just the process of doing science.
Right.
And I would often call home, I'd call my dad and say, you know, guess what I learned today? But I saw it wasn't that way for some people. And many times it seemed to be butting up against particular religious beliefs. And I thought, well, what are they teaching in seminary? And I go to seminary, and it's not so much that they're teaching anything about science, but you cannot hang out in a seminary part-time over 12 years and not have it rub off on you a little bit in terms of kind of looking at the world a little bit differently. And I guess maybe it made me really less interested in the question of what's going on with science and seminary, and maybe more interested in connecting with the experiences that people were having there, and really being in awe of what some people were willing to sacrifice to study to be a minister and you know, do things they felt very deeply about. So it certainly gave me a respect, a deeper respect for religious belief of a particular.
What did you respect? What did
you see that maybe I had?
What did you see that you respected?
Well, that, you know, in some ways, the original question that drove me there, where, you know, what's going on with science in seminary,
right,
became less important than what's going on in seminary, uh-huh, right? Like, what's the draw here? What are people experiencing? Why are they working so hard? And I mean, they really impressed me, and maybe the openness as well to. There were other Unitarian Universalists at the seminary I went to, but by and large, it was a Christian community with a range of different Christian perspectives. But I felt perfectly comfortable there.
What were they working at? What were they working at? What did you see them struggling?
They were working at figuring out how to take. You know, they would people in seminary talk about their calling and why they felt called to go to seminary. And they're figuring out what to do with that. You know, how to best take their beliefs back out into the world and make a difference. And I really admired that. And maybe not that, you know, scientists, they're scientists deeply driven, I think, to do the particular science they do to make a difference. But I will say I saw a level of service in the seminary, this kind of idea of service that I didn't encounter as much in my academic experience of the sciences.
Okay, and that's where your experience of seminary and mine is at complete. Well, not completely different, but in seminary, and I was a college scholar at Cornell, so, and I also worked with some really top science folks. But for every one out of every two professors in seminary would blow your thinking apart in terms of logic, or you missed evidence, or you
right,
didn't get it, or you know, you need to be able to deal with every dimension of this text and the ones you don't like, and really kind of push back. And the intellectual engagement in seminary, one out of two professors was right up at the top, whereas at Cornell, one out of four or five. even in the sciences, we're asking the questions. So the experience you had with your father asking questions and through the science program is actually something that I got even more profoundly, having been already having done biology, anthropology, and ethics at Cornell. I got even more profoundly at Union Seminary. So the taking things apart. And the irony here is I rewrote their vocational and professional development policy in negotiation with the administration and the board of the seminary and all of the factions of students to kind of really get at this being sharply critical and analytical, but also deeply human, which is where the service piece comes in, and how to relate to other people and bring something of value to the table. So I guess did you?
Well, in hearing you speak about that, and maybe I'm missing it here, but I remember. So seminary for me was a deeper introduction to, let's say, other things that matter or other ways of working at the world. But what it didn't do to me is shake me to my core, which I watched some of my Christian colleagues, who perhaps came from more traditional faith systems.
Right.
But, the first class in New Testament was just agonizing for them.
For some of them. Whereas
for me, it was, I can really make this literature my own. I can connect to this literature. This is fascinating. I've often said, if I was going to do it all over again, I'd be a biblical scholar. It was just the digging into that literature and learning about the communities and the challenges and how alive that literature was. I just reveled in it. But I had, I had friends I met in seminary who this was really challenging for them.
Right.
And it was really challenging to look at the text in that way. So it didn't, I don't know if that's what
part of what I'm getting at. And part of it, it makes you have an analytical mind. One of the professors that I worked with, the matriarch of feminist biblical studies of the Hebrew scripture, Phyllis Tribble, coined the term a theology of suspicion. And many earnest Christians have a hard time owning that language, that you can be suspicious and faithful at the same time.
Yeah. And so for me, having that, being shown that that was actually something valued in seminary, this was not core shaking. This was welcome.
Right.
This was a joyful experience from start to end.
So I'm wondering, what I'm wondering is how can you bring that core shaking experience to the Christians and Jews and Muslims who engage this display of artifacts of human evolution and human origins?
Well, I'm not sure. Bring the core shaking experience. I would say I want them to have an opportunity to protect their core in the sense that not feeling that they this is going to be something that's going to threaten their beliefs so much that they shouldn't even look at it.
Right. No, and I guess I'm just asking a different question. And I can see how you would, because I want to shake the beliefs of scientists and I want to shake the beliefs of people who are religious, but not to try to take anything away from them, but to deepen them, take them to a place of appreciation and awareness of the limits of human knowledge and the need for different approaches to it. And for me in this exhibit where that began to happen, and I wish we could have gone into it more deeply, was where that skull was of the 55-year-old man that's, 1.8 million years old,
mm-hmm.
where the all of the teeth had been lost probably 5 years before because the bone had re-smoothed over and been resorbed. And so the person hadn't had the ability to chew for at least 5 years and was in some sense maintained by somebody around him. And we, you know, a part of us wants to infer that this was empathy and this was care and all these good ways, but it could also be propping up an old leader so that the family or the people around him could maintain power as long as this person was still alive, you know, or whatever. We don't necessarily know what it means, but it raises really powerful questions about what good and evil are, and how we interpret evidence in ways that give it one spin versus another, and what we would need to know, and those are the kind of core-shaking conversations that scientists and theologians, or not theologians, but. And I don't mean scientists with a capital S. I mean just people who practice in a rational, scientific way, and people who also practice perhaps in a spiritual way in light of great texts in a subjective worldview.
Yeah, so I think what you've described is how you would hope you could do it. First of all, having the opportunity for people to know about this discovery.
Right.
Right, to know that such a thing exists.
Right.
And then being very careful about how much the science can say about it. And then the rest we need to, you know, we need to bring more to the table when we think about it. And that and to extend that invitation very clearly that here's what we can say from the science. And where do we go from there? Is there something in your tradition that speaks to this, that makes you want to go one or consider one direction over another,
right?
Which is different from my own traditional experience that makes me want to go this way with it, and perhaps in just listening to what other people are thinking about that, I'm going to start rethinking my take on it as well. But it's figuring out a way to extend that invitation.
Right.
That there's really not the answer here. What there is a question.
Right.
But it's an important question to ask. And if you don't know about, if you haven't had a chance to know about the science, you can't even ask the question.
Right. And once you've set it up, you have to have enough of a sense that everybody's voice is valued and authoritative in the room in order for the conversation to proceed. And what's so, the setting up the question, the exhibit does incredibly well. But we walk into rooms where people have all sorts of fears about who's going to speak from from an anti-religious point of view, or who's going to speak from a fundamentalist Christian point of view, or who's going to speak from a whatever, so that we don't really talk to each other and we get kind of timid. And what we say doesn't get at the edges of what we know, and we, as a consequence, we miss each other.
And it certainly takes time, though, doesn't it? I mean, that's one of the, when I think about my experience with the exhibit and these community conversations where you are trying to create a space for people to feel comfortable, and you're trying to do this in an hour and a half, versus my experience with seminarians over a 12-week period, right?
Right. Where
you can really get to know one another. It's tough. How do you certainly there's only so much that the Smithsonian traveling team can do, and really, how much can we encourage the communities to try to find a space to continue to have these types of conversations? But I do hope that at least from our time in the communities, that invitation comes through.
Right. I think what I've heard among Christians of a variety of stripes, Muslims, Jews, and non-religious folks, is that the invitation is clear and earnest, but a way to really engage it is not yet clear. And that's not something you can do in a 3-day visit. I think we can work on it, and that's what I affirm about it, and that's why I've been such a strong supporter, and why I'm having several of you who with the exhibit be on the show, is to kind of keep this in front of the public's eyes, the exploring human origins and what does it mean to be human.
It's a really unique invitation. In my experience of working with the scientific community and individual scientists, hats off to Rick Potts for issuing an invitation like that, the curator of the exhibit.
And the attacks from the scientific side or the atheist side for including religion, I know, have been intense. And from the religious side, it's feeling like it's a little timid in the religion stuff. It's not really engaged, but it's an opening, and we need to figure out how to use this opening and bring about conversation that is profound and useful to people who may not anticipate it being useful. I'm sorry, yeah. I'm just preaching. Now I want to switch gears dramatically. I want to switch gears really dramatically. And
sure.
Because the way I end this show is I ask people, what do you do to restore yourself emotionally, intellectually, physically, on a daily, weekly, monthly, annual basis, or even throughout the day? And how do you know that something needs attention? So how do you do the self-care that keeps your life and the universe around you in perspective?
I go for a bike ride every day.
How long?
And when I don't, about 10 miles, pretty much around my, now it's getting colder, so that's going to get harder to do, and I'll set up a trainer in the basement, which isn't quite the same, but I'll still go for walks with the dog. But I really like starting my day that way, kind of gets my head in the right space. And I also like seeing what's going on out there. You know, like I'll pass the same kids waiting for the school bus or other people taking a walk. And you watch the seasons change throughout the year. It kind of, you know, keeps you connected, keeps your perspective. So that's a big one for me.
Mm-hmm.
And like most people, you know, connecting with your friends. But when I really get frustrated with how things are doing. My husband used to say, you like to mow the lawn because you can see the job's done.
Yes.
And that's how I feel about where, you know, I literally built a bike shop in my basement, and I can go down there, and maybe it's only half an hour a day, but I can tinker on something and see some progress and use my hands, and just sometimes you just got to get out of that space in your head, you know, and really just go take a walk or enjoy the outdoors. So bicycling has become a pretty important thing for me. And having, you know, I want to share that with other people. I really want people to feel comfortable. It's one way, you know, other people might like to run or walk or whatever. But,
right.
It's been very meaningful experience for me, and I would like to pass it on. And if there's people in the community who want a bike, I'm happy to get one fixed up for you and see if we can get it out there.
Right.
So the Rockville Bike Hub has really become a pressure release for me. Although at the same time, you know, you have to be careful. Things that you do for fun don't become your job.
Right. Or kind of an obsessive obligation that you have to kind of.
Right.
Because people are counting on you.
Right. Right. But you know, this is how it happens.
Yeah,
right.
You feel
passionate about something, and before you know it. But you had a second part to that.
Well, I had actually three or four parts to it. You know, one is timing, daily, weekly, monthly, yearly, or throughout the day. The other, and you talked about the physical piece, which kind of helps get your body and kind of work through some of the more intense emotions. But what about, you know, kind of the more refined emotions or your intellectual life? What do you do to kind of keep yourself centered, focused?
You know, I like to at least try to find the space to check in with, you know, take the attention off yourself,
right.
I guess would be my answer to that. And, you know, be aware, especially with your own family, what's going on. But, you know, sometimes that becomes another pressure cooker.
Right. They can drive you, but you also need to be in an engagement, which is back
and
forth.
That's right. I guess I would just say, you know, if my back's up against the wall about something, I'm going to reach out to if I can't reach out to my family, I'm going to reach out to my friends.
Uh-huh.
And I also, you know, I found my own congregation, Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Rockville. I've been going there for 25 years, and it is a place of comfort. If things are going on in the world and I just need to sit. Sometimes you need to sit with people who aren't necessarily challenge you all the time.
Yep.
Just be with your own tribe and
and
feel comfortable. So certainly my association with that congregation has been very powerful. I'm pretty good. If I can just get out into nature, I can reconnect. Mm-hmm. And I can put it back. I can put things back in perspective.
So on a yearly basis,
my family, we go camping a lot. There's other things we can do. We do travel to China every year, which is expensive, but
it's
honestly,
a wonderful
we're
commitment.
Camping because that's the thing that I think, brings us together and refreshes us. And one of the most beautiful things for me about a year ago, maybe the day after Thanksgiving or Thanksgiving weekend, we all took a walk in the woods, and my older daughter expressed to me how grateful she was that, we had done these kind of things with her and how much she enjoyed this. And I'm just like, done, I'm done. Done, you can go off to college, it's all good.
Its success has been achieved, at least for now.
Yeah, that's right, I'm done, thank you.
Yeah, that's beautiful. As we close this out, because this is getting at kind of the sense of completion, what would you hope from scientists and from people who identify as religious? Not that those categories are not exclusive, but what would you hope would be the attitude that they bring to each other in these conversations?
The attitude they bring to each other.
Because this is the behavior that we're going to react to before anything's said.
Yeah. Is there some way you can encourage people to listen? To go into this ready to really listen. Please just try and set aside your... It's hard to do. We all make assumptions.
Right. So what I'm going to project behind what you said is go in with calmness and any of that fear or that rage that you might not get your idea out there or valued, to kind of set that aside and go in there with some sense of peace and openness.
Maybe and also try and assume the best of the person you're in conversation with.
Right.
Try that for a change.
Right. Because I'm playing with this too. Assume equality. Assume that their ideas on the surface are as valuable and as valid as yours.
That's a good. I mean, there's their ideas matter.
Right, and if they don't matter to you now, if you're going to have a relationship, they will have to matter to you in the future.
There's something to say, and there's something to be heard.
Yeah.
And that both of those are equally important. And, if you can just take a deep breath and enjoy the conversation.
Connie, it's been wonderful to get to know you.
Thank you very much. I hope, Eric, that I'm in the area again and I can maybe participate in one of the programs you're putting on.
And I would love that. I would love that. And we're going to close with Indigo Girls and Get Out the Map. Do you want to say anything or play it?
This reminds me of with my kids. Some days we just gotta get out the map and let's go do something.
Okay.
Get out of here.
Yes. Thank you, Connie.
Thank you.
I'm gonna clear my head. I'm gonna drink that sun. The saddest sight my eyes can see is that big ball of orange sinking slyly down the trees, sitting in a broken circle while you rest upon my knee. this perfect moment to me leaving me. Suzanne calls from Boston, the coffee's hot, the corn is high, and that same sun that warms your heart will suck that gutter dry. With everything it's opposite, enough to keep you crying, or keep this whole world spinning with a twinkle in its eye. Get out the map, get out the map, lay your finger anywhere down. Believe the figure into those we pass on our way out of town. We'll drink the water, there seems to be something ailing everyone. I'm gonna clear my head, I'm gonna drink that sun. I'm gonna love you good and strong while I love is good and young.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and that concludes the Made of Clay Report.